Hello and welcome to AstroTalk UK. AT UK is a not-for-profit 30-minute weekly audio podcast primarily for and by amateur astronomers in the UK. Available only online, AT UK is a virtual meeting point for the amateur astronomy community. Each episode is an MP3 file which can be downloaded automatically with a free subscription via one of the many podcast readers. I use iTunes. My name is Gurbir Singh, and I host AT UK. I am not a scientist, nor am I an astronomer. Topics of discussion have no fixed boundaries other than their relevance to amateur astronomy. Each week's episode consists of pre-recorded conversations with individuals discussing their roles, lives, and achievements of amateur astronomers and their hobby. More about AT UK at www.astrotalkuk.org. If you have a topic for discussion, drop me a note on info@astrotalkuk.org. AstroTalk UK, amateur astronomy, expert opinion. Episode 7, Sunday, March the 16th, 2008. In today's episode, we hear from three individuals who have made a unique contribution in amateur astronomy. Mark Armstrong, supernova discoverer, Chris Marriott of SkyMap, and the man from West Yorkshire Astronomical Society, who arranges the most special speakers that any astronomical society can aspire to. Between 1969 and 1972, 9 spacecraft from the Apollo program, with 24 men, made return journeys to the moon and 12 walked on its surface. Of the 24, 3, Jim Lovell, John Young and Gene Cernan made that journey twice, but only Gene Cernan made it to the surface. If you are under 40 years old now, you will have no idea of the sensation of the achievement of the Apollo program. I will be 50 next month. I wish it was 60, because as a 21-year-old in 69, my experience of that unique event in human history would have been much more complete than I remember it from the age of 11. As Carl Sagan put it, only one generation in the history of the human species is privileged to live during the time those great discoveries are made, and that generation is ours. No one has gone back to the moon since 1972, and of the 12 who made it to the surface, only 9 remain, and they are all in their 70s. Two of them, Alan Bean and Charlie Duke, were guest speakers at West Yorkshire Astronomical Society. Buzz Aldrin is due there on March the 30th. The drive and effort behind getting these unique individuals to Pontefract is the work of one man, Vice President of West Yorkshire Astronomical Society, Ken Willoughby. Ken, before we talk about the astronauts, what's your interest in astronomy? What got you started?
Well, my interest is everything. I try to keep in with all the latest developments. But I also like the history of it as well, mm-hmm. and naked eye observing, especially when there's comets. They are the main things, but I do try and take an interest in all aspects of it. That started a long, long time ago. It feels like 1600 and something. But I liked mythology. That was the first thing I liked when I was... Right. And it was reading the Iliad and Odyssey, the journey home where he navigated by the stars of Orion, the Pleiades. Uh-huh. And I was always told that this Battle of Troy, that never took place. Uh-huh. So I thought, well, what's Orion? What are the Pleiades? So then I got a book from the library.
Right.
And I thought, oh, they are up there in the sky.
Right.
So it started from there. I just went out and tried to find Orion, uh-huh. looking at the picture in the book, and I did. And once I looked up, I never looked down.
So how old were you when you had your very first telescope?
I didn't get a telescope for a good few years because then, and I still do, I think for at least the first 12 months you should just go out and look. There's so much to see with the naked eye. and then a pair of binoculars. Everybody's got a pair of binoculars. Mm-hmm. Have a band sound. But to me, it's, if you go out nowadays and you get one of these modern telescopes, you press a button, it goes to M84 or whatever. What is the point of the telescope doing that? You're looking at it. If you can't find M84, if you can't look up and say, well, it's there in that constellation below so-and-so star. That's what I like to do. But
Apollo astronauts, how did you first get involved with them?
I've always been interested in the space program. Obviously, like millions of others on the planet, I watched the Eagle land. Mm-hmm. Later on, when I became chairman here and I was booking guest speakers, I thought it would be nice to bring one to Pontefract, but I never ever dreamed that they would. Uh-huh. I started going out to Autographica and meeting people. 2004, I took my granddaughter down actually, and Charlie Joke was there. My team got his autograph, had a few photos, and I just said, do you fancy coming to Pontefract and talking to the people at night and the school kids in the afternoon? Mm-hmm. He just said, no problem, and gave me his card.
Right.
He said, email me.
Right.
That was on a Saturday. I think he was probably going back on the Chosey to America. But on Saturday night, I got all my email in then to make sure.
Yeah.
And it went from there. We arranged a visit in March 05. But then, about December, he had to cancel because something cropped up. So we put it back to October.
Mm-hmm.
And then the following year, in 06, I went to the local star party at Burr.
Mm-hmm.
And there I met Triple Nickel, who trains the astronauts out on the shuttle.
Uh-huh.
And he takes them up in the vomit comet.
Oh, yeah.
You know, to get them used to a bit of weightlessness.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And I asked him if he'd come over, and he said yes, that was no problem. And when I got back from Burr, I thought, I wonder if another of the Apollo men would come over. So I emailed Charlie and said, have you got Alan Bean's email? Because I'd like him to come over. Gave me Alan's email.
Right.
Contacted.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, no problem. If you don't ask, you don't get.
Okay. Yeah.
He said yes or no. He mentioned how much it costs. So no problem. He wanted $50,000.
Uh-huh.
And then there's the flight. And so, no problem.
Uh-huh.
And they've been in contact, and it's come off for March the 30th.
Currently, how many astronauts have visited so far?
We've had two. Charlie Joke, the 10th man, and Alan Bean, the 4th man, to stand on the moon.
Right.
And then on March the 30th, we have Buzz Aldrin. And October the 10th, later this year, we have Fred Hayes from Apollo 13.
Just for somebody who hasn't been to one of these events, what we're talking about is one of these Apollo astronauts coming to West Yorkshire and doing a presentation in the evening only for the public?
Charlie Joke and Alan Bean, they talk to school children in the afternoon, mm-hmm, and the public at night. With Buzz, we have a very short time.
Mm-hmm.
It's arriving very early on the Sunday morning,
mm-hmm,
and we don't really have time for a talk to school children in the afternoon. And it's on a Sunday as well.
Right.
So you would be a bit pushed to get them in. So the evening talk is starting early, because on the Monday he has to go, he has to leave Pontefract at 5 a.m. Monday morning to get back down to London. So we are very limited with time. You know, it really is a flying visit.
Buzz Aldrin's visit on the 30th of March?
30th of March.
How much is it to come along?
The tickets are £20, but they sold out in the first fortnight.
How much does it cost to get an astronaut over?
Buzz Aldrin, it would cost $50,000 for him to talk,
mm-hmm,
plus $15,000 for the flight, because his wife comes with him. He is coming over here for the premiere of In the Shadow of the Moon,
uh-huh,
which is on the Monday, I think, the 31st of March.
Mm-hmm.
And I had this email saying that he was coming over. Do I want him to come and talk to us?
Right.
Well, he would be arriving Sunday morning,
mm-hmm,
and have to go back down to London. Yeah. And money, so I said, well, yeah. So I just offered $30,000,
uh-huh,
plus obviously transport from airport.
For a lot of amateur societies, these are quite large sums of money. So you are able to recoup all of that from the ticket sales?
No, what I tried to do, to give everyone, or the lucky ones, because we can only seat 550 people, the idea is to keep the price as low as mm-hmm. we can do. And then we apply for grants and a bit of sponsorship donation of some other people. Mm-hmm. The local education authority chips in, because it is at the school, you know. And we do get a few grants from the councils, because it's for people potted around here, so the council's chipping as well. Mm-hmm. So we don't make money out of it. We don't want to. We just want to give everybody that opportunity at a reasonable mm-hmm. price.
The ages of these astronauts now, they must all be in their 70s.
Moses is 78.
78.
Yeah, Charlie York's the youngest, I think. Yeah, he was 70 when he came to us in 04. So he'll be 74 this year.
I'm looking forward to Buzz Aldrin on the Sunday, the
30th of March.
And after that, you've got two coming.
On the 10th of October, Friday the 10th of October, later this year, we do have Fred Hayes from Apollo 13. And for October 2009, we have lined up Jim Cernan, who was the last man on the moon. And there may be another one in between.
Given their age and so few in number, that's remarkable.
I offer them the Pontefract cakes and they can't refuse.
Ken Willoughby, past chairman and current vice president of West Yorkshire Astronomical Society. Thank you very much indeed.
No problem.
Earth-based observers have discovered comets, asteroids, even planets. But the first discovery of supernovae was made by Astronomy Now's Mark Armstrong in 1996 from Kent. I asked Mark if this was the first ever discovery of supernova in another galaxy by an amateur astronomer.
Yes, that's correct. So I got the first ever discovery from the UK that's an amateur or professional astronomer. That was in October 1996.
And whereabouts in the sky was that, and what was it called?
It was in the constellation of Aries, in a galaxy which was designated NGC 673. Just a typical galaxy. You can't see it with the naked eye. One of, you know, thousands of typical galaxies.
After that discovery, you went on to discover many more.
Yeah, I've got 73 at the moment. So it was a steady process from 1996. I started off just using one telescope, but as the competition increased, I ended up with three telescopes, and then the rate of discoveries tended to take off after that.
You're not doing that right now?
No, at the present time, I'm working for Astronomy Now.
When you were discovering supernovae, what was the configuration of telescopes you had in your observatory?
Yeah, I had ended up with three telescopes, so it was three of the best mounts you could get, American mounts, unfortunately, but they were very good, very accurate mounts, very accurate in tracking, very accurate in their accuracy to find objects. Coupled with that was a C14 Celestron telescope, which is a 14-inch telescope, Smith-Cassegrain design. Coupled with a very sensitive CCD. So with that system, you'd be bound to make discoveries, really.
So how did it work? Did you take a lot of pictures at night time, and then the following day you would look for new stars in these images?
Yeah, what happened was, over time you build up a library of what we called master images of galaxies. It was up to 10,000 galaxies that I used to patrol. So you had a good image of down to magnitude 19, perhaps 19.5. It was just a question then of every clear night going out, depending on what part of the sky was best placed. You patrol a certain number of galaxies that night. And then it's just a question of checking your image taken on the night against your master image and looking for any differences. And if there was a new star present, it could be a supernova. It could have, often it was an asteroid. I've actually discovered two asteroids as well, new asteroids. But if you're lucky, it might be a supernova.
That detection was always optical. You had to do it by eye yourself.
Yes, I had no software help. The automation, the telescopes were automated. You could set them off, give them a script, if you like, mm-hmm. and they would run through the script, and the software would save the image to disk. But all the check-in was manual.
So the script was a program that would say to one telescope, go and look at this particular galaxy, take a picture for so long, then move on to the next.
That's correct, yes. And you'd have scripts for every part of the sky.
You mentioned you discovered two asteroids as well?
That's right, yes. During the course of... I tend to patrol the whole sky, and so that means going near the path where the asteroids gather. There's thousands of asteroids already known, but luckily I discovered two that weren't known. It's just really a question of you have to catch them on the night, because if you miss them, mm-hmm. obviously they're going to be moved away from that field of view. So if you catch it and you see it on the night, you perhaps wait half an hour, and take another image. And if it's moved, obviously it's not a supernova then it's an asteroid. Then it's a question of following it for as long as you can, and then you can measure its position against the background stars. And if you're lucky, it's a new one.
This special interest in supernovae, does it have any specific origin?
It was just a question of seeing I took a photograph of a galaxy which had a supernova in it when I first started. There was some question of whether this supernova had brightened sufficiently. So people wanted an image. So I took an image, and there are various amateur publications which are around, and the picture was on the front page of that magazine. So that's the kind of thing that sort of spur you on. And I knew that people had been looking for supernovae, so I thought maybe I could do it. And that's how it started, really.
It's a bit of a hiatus, your astronomy right now. What do you think you'd be going back to in the future? Back to supernovae hunting?
Well, while I'm working for Astronomy Now full-time, it's sort of difficult to envisage sort of staying up all night and stuff. But what I do hope to do, I have a fancy for perhaps doing some wide-field imaging of the sky, some of the nice objects. It's less scientific, but it's I see many nice images in the magazine, working for the magazine, and I do have a fancy for perhaps doing something like that, or maybe some variable stars, just monitoring some stars which vary over time, to try and do some science. So I still would like to possibly, you know, to get some decent science out of what I do.
Well, you've made a tremendous contribution already with your supernova work. Mark Armstrong from Astronomy Now, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much.
If you want to know your way around the sky, it used to be a planisphere or Norton's Sky Atlas. These days, numerous online sources provide you with a view of the night sky from anywhere at any time. Google Sky was launched in 2007, and in spring of 2008, so any time now, Microsoft will launch the Worldwide Telescope. On the laptops of most amateur astronomers, however, they will have installed dedicated astronomy application, such as Redshift, Starry Night, or SkyMap. SkyMap is the brainchild of one dedicated individual. Chris Marriott, Mr. SkyMap, welcome to AstroTalk UK.
Thank you very much.
SkyMap, Chris, what is it?
What SkyMap is it is a Windows application which basically, as the name suggests, draws maps of the sky. So it'll let amateur astronomers see what the sky looks like as seen from anywhere in the world at any time.
And that time, I understand, is any time between 47,000 BC to 9999 AD.
No, 4,700 BC. In fact, to be specific, 4,712 BC.
Why those dates?
The 9999 AD is just arbitrary, but the 4,712 BC is the start of what's called the Julian day number system, which is a uniform way of numbering dates, which was invented by a Victorian chappie and whose zero point is at that specific date.
Now, there's quite a few other astronomy programs of this nature, but I understand SkyMap's probably the most accurate.
Accuracy has certainly always been my goal for it, simply on the grounds that if you wait a couple of years, computers will always get faster. Mm-hmm. But if a program isn't sufficiently accurate, there is no way to make it more so. So accuracy is more important than speed, because if it's not fast enough, you can just get a faster PC.
And of course, do you describe yourself as a mathematician?
Well, I'm, by training, I'm a physicist. So I did a degree in physics, and then for many years I worked in the nuclear industry, where I was doing mathematical modelling. I've always had an interest in writing computer models which model the real world, as it were.
What are the data sources that the SkyMap uses?
Well, there are basically two sorts of information. There is stuff which is in catalogues, like stars and nebulae and galaxies and what have you. And then there are things which it computes itself, which are things like the positions of the planets. And all the star catalogues are available free on the internet.
Current version, SkyMap 11 Pro?
SkyMap Pro 11, that's right, yes.
Comes with digitised sky survey, Hubble Guide Star Catalogue, and LEDA Galaxy Catalogue.
It doesn't come with the digitised sky survey. It can interface to it on the internet.
As with any live applications, you can download the ephemeris for comets, satellites.
Oh, absolutely, yes, absolutely. That's just okay. These days it's very much integrated with the internet. So provided you have a computer which has an internet connection, all you have to do is just click a button and it'll automatically download the latest data for comets or asteroids or artificial satellites.
At SkyMap, you can drive your telescope with it as well?
Yes, absolutely. If you have any modern telescope which can be computer-controlled, then SkyMap will drive it, which is very nice because when you do that, you can just click the mouse on any object on the map, tell the telescope to point itself there, and then hopefully when you look through the eyepiece you will see the object.
And if you don't, it's down to your tracking, of course,
or it's cloudy, which happens a lot in Manchester.
You have a Yahoo user group, you have a mailing list, you keep all the elements up to date. It's still quite a demanding job for you at the moment.
Not really, no, it's not. Unfortunately, for various reasons, I'm not doing much active development on the programme at the moment. But actually maintaining the data up to date, it's pretty much of a routine matter these days.
How many users of SkyMap are there out there?
Oh, thousands. I don't know how many thousand, but a lot, certainly. I mean, obviously, a specialised application like SkyMap, it's never going to compete in numbers with applications aimed at the average man in the street, like Microsoft Word or games or things like that. But it does reasonably well. Yes.
When did you start working on SkyMap?
I started working on it in 1982, around about. So that's about 26 years now.
Wow.
Something like that.
Chris, are you a regular observer? Do you have a telescope that you take out every night?
I am the world's worst observer. I can recognise about three constellations, I'm afraid. I am strictly a mathematical astronomer. I can compute to the nth decimal place where a comet is going to be in the sky, but if you asked me to actually go outside and look at it without the aid of SkyMap, then I'd be in big trouble. And I do have a now rather elderly Meade LX200 telescope, which is well over 10 years old now, which I actually use in my testing of the telescope driving mechanisms in SkyMap and things like that. But I'm afraid it just sits on my office floor. It never goes outside.
What do you do for a living?
These days I'm a software engineer working for a large corporation.
When you're not working, what do you do with your, and not working at SkyMap, what else do you do with your free time?
Oh, I enjoy reading very, very much, and the other interest in my life is classics. I've taught myself Latin and Greek, and I enjoy reading works in those languages, which I realise is a rather odd thing, but I find it fascinating.
Well, early astronomy and Latin and Greek, of course, have very strong connections.
Absolutely right, yes, and the Greek philosophers especially, they had a lot of interesting ideas about the way the universe was created and the way it worked and so on. And in fact, I think it was at least largely through my interest in the history of astronomy that I did get interested in the ancient world.
Those days in the ancient world, astrology, not astronomy, was prominent. Technically, you could have a version of SkyMap which would give astrological predictions. Do you have any interest in that area?
No, absolutely none. In fact, I'm afraid I have rather serious objections to that. I'm sure there are honest astrologers around, but I'm afraid my general view is that many of them are fleecing ignorant people out of their money. I think it's a purely commercial scam, for want of a better word.
Have you ever had any requests for an astrological equivalent of SkyMap?
Frequently, yes. It's something in which I get asked for quite a lot. And in fact, I know that quite a few people have bought it to use for that purpose.
Chris Marriott, founder of SkyMap, thank you very much indeed.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to AstroTalk UK. AT UK is a non-profit project produced and recorded by Gurbir Singh. He nor any of the participants are paid for their contribution. AT UK's content is not validated against any authoritative source, and all the views and opinions are held by those who choose to express them. If you have a topic of interest you would like to discuss on AT UK, drop me a note, info@astrotalkuk.org.